George, a choice that wasn't really a choice at all. Like the executioner asking if you'd prefer to have your head severed from your body or your body from your head. Olive smiled at George. Would you like me to go first, or Miss Joy? George took a step forward.
You think I'm an idiot? He said. I'm not letting you go into the bathroom by yourself.
Well, I hardly think you'd care to watch, she replied. She got to her feet. I don't really think I can wait much longer for you to decide, dear. The muscles in the urinary tract just aren't what they used to be.
For God's sake, George cut her off. He stepped forward, grabbing her arm. Come on.
There was a small single-person restroom off the waiting room where they were all sitting. George dragged her toward it and turned on the light, then gave her a rough pat down.
Go,
he said. But when Olive tried to close the door, he pushed it back open.
If you don't want to do it this way, you don't get to do it at all.
Olive considered arguing with him, but in the end, she just nudged the door closed a bit. It remained open for all intents and purposes, but she was mostly shielded from the view of everyone.
Think, Olive, think.
She did not have a lot of time. She couldn't stand on the toilet and try to send a signal through the small window. George would hear her scrambling and could poke his head in at any time. She pulled up her skirt, wriggled her underpants down, and sat on the toilet seat. Beside it was a small cart with specimen bottles and labels and a Sharpie so that you could write your name on the plastic. Olive grabbed the pen and unspooled the toilet paper.
There are six of us and one of him, she wrote across three of the squares. We need a plan. Thoughts?
She knew that whatever the others plotted, she would be at a disadvantage. But she also knew to look for a signal and to act. Olive pulled up her panties and flushed the toilet. She rolled the paper back up, with the writing carefully tucked in a way that it couldn't be seen until it was unspooled. She washed her hands and opened the door and smiled at George.
There, she said. That wasn't so bad, was it?
When Olive came out of the bathroom, Joy stood up, letting herself be manhandled by that crazy asshole before she stepped inside. While she peed, she looked at the pad in her underpants, which was soaked, but not soaked through, and this was a good thing, since she didn't have a replacement. Then she pulled the roll of toilet paper to ball it up in her hand. Except she didn't. She read. Then she took the Sharpie and began to write. Janine had hoped that the shooter would cut her a little slack, forego the pat-down or let her close the door. After all, they both believed in the same sanctity of life, even if he had a pretty bad track record with that at present. Instead, he treated her just like one of the other women. Janine unraveled the toilet paper roll. She looked at the notes in different handwriting. Olive's first statement, and then Joy. What if we jump him? She could do one of two things right now. She could take all the toilet tissue and flush it, sabotaging the work of the other women, or she could admit that through a strange twist of fate, her goals had aligned with theirs. Right now, Janine was not holding a sign with a picture of an unborn child on it. She was not praying for the mothers who were walking past her. She was the person being prayed for. On any given day, she could have told you that inside this clinic, lives were at risk. Today, the life was hers. She reached for the Sharpie. Trip him, she wrote, and go for the gun. When Ren was growing up,
She thought there was nothing worse than having a mother who had actually chosen a life that did not include her. Her mom still hit the high water marks, birthday, Christmas, with a card and a present, usually something from Paris, that was so not Ren's style she buried it in the back of her closet, not having the heart to throw it away. Her mom had hinted that now that Ren was older, maybe she wanted to come spend summers in France. Ren would have rather vacationed on the front lines of a war zone. She may have owed her mother for the 9 months she carried her in her womb, but that was it. On the other hand, if there was some divine power, he or she had made up for the loss of her mother by giving her a father who was there for her 200%. Unlike her friends who were always complaining that their parents didn't get them, Ren actually liked being in her dad's company. He was the first person she texted when she got an A on a test she had been sure she failed. He told her, honestly, if a pair of jeans made her hips look wide. He taught her about the night sky. Her dad was also the person you wanted next to you in an emergency. When she went to Lola Harding's birthday party and a few idiots were getting drunk, and a kid accidentally sliced his hand open cutting limes and everyone was freaking out, Ren had called her father, who called 911 and came over and took control and didn't go ballistic and call everyone's parents, but somehow managed to put the fear of God into the guy who'd brought the Jägermeister. When Ren was 10 and had, on a dare, tried to climb a rose trellis and wound up in the hospital with a broken leg, her father had sat beside her, trying to comfort her, when the painkillers didn't. "Pant sweat," he had said. And she'd been distracted enough to stop crying and obsessing over the fact that she could see her bone through the break in her skin. Her dad had tugged at the leg of her sweatpants. "There are just some compound words that you should never reverse."
"Finger chicken," she had said.
"Litter kitty."
"Pot coffee."
All things considered, she wished he was here. She had liked being able to text him. It was the next best thing. But since she and Olive had been dragged from their hiding place, that wasn't a possibility. Except now. The second it was her turn to go to the bathroom, she was going to fire up her phone again and tell her dad everything that was going on. From where she was sitting on the couch, Ren narrowed her eyes and stared at George. He had been on the phone with her dad, but now the phone was on the receptionist's counter. He held the gun in his right hand. He was sweating. He had ghost eyes, so light, with the pupils just pinpricks, almost like you could see right through him. And if the doctor and Izzy were right, he had a daughter. That may even have been the reason he'd come here. Ren knew better than anyone that you couldn't choose your parents, but she wondered what it would be like if she had grown up with this man instead of her father. She wondered what his daughter was thinking right now. Suddenly, he was waving the gun in her face.
"What are you waiting for?" he said. "Get moving."
She stood and held up her bound hands.
"I can't, you know, like this."
For an awful second, she thought he was going to tell her to deal with it. Then he scrabbled at her wrists, feeling for the edge of the tape, and unraveled her. Ren felt blood flood to her hands. She shook them at her sides.
"Do not," he said, "do anything stupid."
Ren nodded, but she had a feeling that what she thought was stupid and what he thought was stupid were two very different things. The door was left open. She sat down on the toilet lid and fished in her sock for her phone. Olive had managed to turn it off so that it wouldn't keep buzzing. When she powered it up again, though, it would make a noise. Ren reached toward the sink and began to run the water to mask it. She held her breath, muffling the phone against her shirt.
She waited for a signal so that she could text her father. No service. That made no sense. She'd had a full signal when she was in the closet, and her phone had buzzed when she was taken into the waiting room, before Olive had turned it off for her. Ren fiddled with the cellular settings. She tried to find a Wi-Fi network. Nothing. When her aunt had been shot, Ren had turned into a statue. She hadn't been able to move. She probably would have stood there just waiting to be killed if Olive hadn't dragged her into the closet. Her heart had been pounding so hard, she thought it would break the cage of her ribs. She had never been so scared in her life, and every time she closed her eyes, she saw that bright banner of blood unfurl on Aunt Bex's chest. But being able to text her father, knowing her father was right on the other side of that brick wall, well, it had tethered Ren to sanity. Now that was gone. What if she never got out of this clinic? She was 15 years old. She hadn't had sex. She hadn't gone to prom. She hadn't smoked a joint or pulled an all-nighter. Her dad was always telling her to be careful, that he saw far too many mangled car wrecks or drunk drivers who were teens who thought they were invincible. Maybe it sounded ridiculous given the fact that she had been jerked out of the closet and had a gun pointed at her face, but for the first time Ren now really understood she could die. A fresh wave of terror settled over her, and she started to shake. She grabbed one hand with the other. She closed her eyes tight and tried to imagine every detail of her father's face. If her dad were here, he'd tell her to take a deep breath. He'd say, "Make sure you're safe. Make sure everyone else is, too." He'd say, "Bedwater," she thought. She let a tiny smile slip out from inside that knot of fear. Way high. Paper toilet. For the first time since she had been in the bathroom, she looked at the toilet paper roll. She saw the message thread and began to read.
"What the hell is taking you so long?" George said, and he yanked open the door.
Ren did the first thing she could think of. She dropped her phone in the toilet, along with the paper in her fist.
I'm almost done, she stammered.
His face receded, and Ren doubled over. She stood up and fished for her phone in the bowl, but it was ruined. Then again, it hadn't been working anyway, and it was better to have it hidden than on her. She knew from watching the others that they had received pat-downs from George when they left the bathroom, too. Holding the device by a dripping corner, she lifted the toilet tank cover and hid the phone inside. She looked down at the soggy mess of toilet paper in the bowl. Ren took the marker on the side table and wrote on the roll, succinctly, what Izzy would need to know. She and the doctor were the only ones who hadn't gone to the bathroom yet, and the doctor probably couldn't even get to his feet. "We can take him down, trip him, go for the gun. Everyone's in." She rolled the words back up, flushed the toilet, rinsed her hands, and stepped outside. George was waiting, tapping the gun against his thigh. She felt lost without her phone. Untethered. She could remember asking her dad once what happened during a spacewalk if an astronaut became untethered from the spacecraft. He explained that they wore backpacks they could fire up, with jets to propel them back to the vehicle. They were called Simplified Aid for EVA Rescue. Safer. She took a step toward the couch, feeling the shooter's eyes on her.
"Did you forget something?" he said.
Ren drew in her breath and shook her head. Had he seen her holding the phone? George grabbed her by the wrist and pulled her toward the others.
"Tape her up," he ordered Izzy.
"I'm sorry," Izzy said. The tape roll went around twice, three times. Then Izzy tried to tear it. When that didn't work, she leaned forward, her hair falling over her face and Ren's wrists as she bit the edge of the tape with her teeth. Izzy looked up, catching Ren's eye for a moment. Then she turned to George.
I believe it's my turn.
Ren stumbled back to the couch, gingerly sitting down beside Olive again. She gently settled her bound hands in her lap and looked down at them. Clasped between her palms was a scalpel Izzy had managed to pass to her, with a tiny, lethal blade.
Dishonorably discharged.
The words chased themselves around George's mind. What if Lil had heard that? She knew that he had been in the army, and she also knew that he didn't like to talk about his time there. But shit, neither did anyone who had seen combat. He had been in Bosnia, stationed in a hellhole where he was supposed to be keeping the peace, but even he knew, early days as it was, that there was no way they could win this one. It had been the end of a long day at the end of a long week, and he was drinking at a bar. He'd gone outside to take a piss and had heard a woman's scream. He should have ignored it. But he thought about his wife back home, and instead rounded the corner to find two men holding down a Muslim woman. No, make that a girl. A Muslim girl. She couldn't have been more than 12. He assumed, given the ethnic conflict, that the men were Serbs, but they all looked alike. One held his hand over her mouth and pinned her shoulders. The other was vigorously pumping between her thighs. George pulled him off, sending him sprawling into the dust. His friend came after George, who landed a solid punch. The man staggered and fell, his head smacking against the curb. George was dimly aware that the girl had scrambled off. The rapist got to his feet and came toward George, who leveled his weapon. By then, the commotion had drawn a crowd. What they saw was an American soldier holding a Croatian civilian at gunpoint, while a second civilian bled to death at his feet. He was court-martialed. He explained that he had interrupted a rape, but the girl's family insisted that she had not been sexually assaulted, and why would they admit she had, since it would make her forever unmarriageable in their culture? Instead, there was testimony from the bystanders who had seen George pointing a gun wildly at a man who had fallen to the ground with his hands up. George was convicted of manslaughter and dishonorably discharged, goddammit, for doing the right thing. When he came home, he had a wife who didn't understand his anger and a baby who screamed all the time, and he couldn't get any sleep. He got fired from his job and maybe drank more than he should. One night when he fell asleep on the couch, Greta had leaned over him to wake him up, but he had been dreaming and saw instead that girl, the Muslim girl, and he grabbed her by the throat with all his frustration.
Why didn't you tell them the truth? I saved you. Why didn't you save me?
It wasn't until Greta started to go slack beneath him that he realized where he was, who he was. When he let go of his wife, she ran to the bedroom and locked the door. He begged for forgiveness. He promised he'd go to counseling. She didn't answer, just stayed away from him, wearing a necklace of bruises. When he called her name the next day, she jumped in fear. She did everything she could to avoid him. George took to sleeping in the baby's room because he knew Greta wouldn't leave without Lil. Until one night she did. He glanced up at the television screen. It was dark now, turned off at his command. But he could still hear the words of the reporter ringing in his head.
Dishonorable discharge is reserved for the military's most reprehensible conduct, the man had said. Desertion, sexual assault, murder, egregious violence.
Egregious violence. George felt sweat trickle down his back. He pulled at his collar.
Egregious fucking violence.
There was nothing egregious about it. They didn't know what went down in Bosnia. They didn't realize it hadn't been Greta's face he saw that night when he tried to strangle her. They didn't understand what had happened to Lil that had led him here. He could not hear anything except that reporter's voice, ringing in his ears.
Egregious violence, George muttered. This is egregious violence, he said,
and he slammed his boot into the injured leg of the doctor. When George's hearing returned, it was with the man's scream. The gunman was out of control. He was muttering to himself. He had stomped on Dr. Ward's leg. Izzy bent down over the poor man, soothing, trying to do something, anything, to stave off the pain. Dr. Ward was shivering, sweating, in shock. The false comfort of the status quo had been shredded, and what would happen next was anyone's guess. She glanced over at Wren. The girl had her eyes screwed shut as if she was trying to will this into a nightmare instead of reality. She must still be holding the scalpel. Izzy had known she had to get rid of it as soon as she saw the shooter doing full body checks before and after each woman went to the bathroom. She blotted Dr. Ward's forehead with a strip of gauze. On the pretense of ministering to him, she said loudly, "Shh. It's all right. It will help if you focus on something else right now." Izzy looked up as the other women turned at the sound of her voice. She made eye contact with each of them in turn. "Think of a nice beach, maybe. Down on the Gulf Coast. I don't get down there very much myself, but my boyfriend and I, we keep talking about taking a trip." If the shooter noticed that she stressed that last word, he didn't show it. There was a charged moment of silence. They had all read the missive in the bathroom, but there hadn't been an explicit plan of action. Suddenly, Joy grabbed her belly and jackknifed forward.
"Ow!" she moaned. "It hurts. It hurts like crazy."
She began rocking back and forth.
"Shut her up," the shooter commanded.
He turned to Izzy.
"Do something."
Izzy moved toward Joy. "Do you still feel the pain?"
"Yes,"
Joy said, squeezing Izzy's hand three times, a sign.
"Right now," she screamed.
"Shut her up," George said. "Shut her up or I'll—"
He stepped forward, either to threaten or to cold cock her, but as he did, Janine stretched out a foot. Just like that, George Goddard went sprawling.
Now.
Wren watched him trip, and when he did, he dropped the gun. When she was very little, she used to imagine what it would feel like to fly. On windy days, she would unzip her raincoat and spread her arms and leap into the air and know, just know, that she was airborne for an extra heartbeat. Now, she flew. She leaped off of the couch and dove for the gun at the same time George did. Her hands were still tied, so she went down like a stone and wriggled on her elbows. It was a tenth of a second and at the same time, an eternity. She felt her fingertips graze the barrel of the gun, and he knocked it away from her. Wren raised her bound hands and slammed them down as hard as she could into his outstretched palm. He howled, and the scalpel stuck deep in his flesh, sliding from between Wren's palms.
"You bitch!"
he cried. He yanked the blade from his hand and then grabbed the gun. Wren couldn't get up. Her hands were still tied. The angle of the scalpel when she had held it had made it impossible to cut the tape, although she had tried like hell. She scooted backward on the carpet, slipping in the fresh blood from Dr. Ward's injury. In that moment, all she could see was the shooter's red, red eyes. and the twist of his face and his thumb pulling back the trigger, she wondered if it would hurt when she returned to Stardust. What we know, Olive could tell you, is not what we think we know. 1 year she had run a psychological study in which she told her collegiate subjects that scientists had discovered a chemical that had anti-aging benefits. When told that the scientists didn't really know how that worked yet, the students reported not understanding how the anti-aging effects occurred. But when told that scientists had figured out the methodology, the students reported an understanding of the process, even without being given the details. It was almost as if knowledge was contagious. People constantly claimed to know something when they didn't have the facts and tools to uphold their claims. Maybe for this reason, she thought that at this moment, she would be reliving the high water marks of her life, the memories of love and joy and justice. She thought she would see her first kiss with a girl made of moonlight in a lake at summer camp, or her last kiss with Peg, when each put a bookmark in her reading material and curled toward the other, like parentheses, before they turned out the light. Olive thought, and therein lay the mistake. When it came down to it at the end, you did not think, you felt. What did she feel? That you will never cease to underestimate yourself. That love is fleeting. That life is a miracle. That the reason she had come to this clinic on this day, at this hour, was this. Acting purely on instinct, Olive LeMay threw herself in front of the bullet. 2 p.m. The sunlight was overwhelming. Izzy watched it glint off the silver bars of the wheelchair. She was temporarily blinded and then forced herself to put one foot in front of the other to push the wheels over the threshold of the clinic door. It wasn't just the sunlight, though. It was cameras and shouted questions as someone emerged from the belly of the beast. Izzy froze, unsure of where to go and what to do. She was supposed to wheel Bex outside and then walk back through those doors. But it would be so easy to save herself. She could lean forward low and dynamic and run. She could bring Bex to the ambulance and leap inside, and really, what could the shooter do? Her vision cleared as a man stepped forward. In silhouette, he was tall and broad-shouldered, and for just a moment she thought, Parker. But Izzy was not the one being rescued now. And anyway, in her fairy tale, she was still afraid that any moment the prince might realize she was just a poor villager posing as a princess. The hostage negotiator held out a hand and beckoned her forward. She felt like she was suspended between what could be and what was, just like always. It was that way for all people who grew up poor, she imagined. Izzy had vivid memories of her birthday being celebrated 2 weeks after the fact, because that's when they could afford a box of cake mix. Of always adding water to the milk to stretch it. Of being giddy when the food stamps came in and you could go to the grocery store, and being ashamed when you had to actually use them to pay. When Izzy was in first grade, her family couldn't afford school supplies, so she pretended that she had forgotten them at home. Then one day when she opened her little flip-top desk, there was a brand new box of Crayola crayons. They were still pointy at the top, and smelled like wax and had a sharpener on the back. Izzy had no idea if it was her teacher who had given them to her, and she never found out. But she did realize then that her family was different from other families. Most kids didn't go to Sam's Club for lunch when you weren't even a member, because you could make the rounds for free samples. ketchup sandwiches with packets stolen from McDonald's weren't normal. Her mother rummaged through her brother's backpacks and threw out the flyers for the Scholastic Book Club, for field trips, for dances, for anything that was an additional expense. When they ate dinner, Izzy would pretend to be full, because she knew her mother wouldn't have any food if she didn't leave some behind on her plate. As she worked through high school, she was determined to have a different life. She couldn't afford an SAT prep course, so she asked another student for the syllabus and then got books through interlibrary loans and taught herself. She applied for more than 100 scholarships that she found online using the library's public internet. She didn't get them all, but she got enough for a free education. She went to nursing school on student loans, and she scrimped and saved. And then she met Parker, who had taken her on her first vacation, who couldn't believe that she'd never gone to a doctor growing up, only the school nurse, who didn't require insurance, who had found her adding water to the shampoo so it lasted longer, who had proposed, in spite of all this. If she had told Parker about the pregnancy, he would have been thrilled. He would have used it as leverage to make her say yes instead of, "I need more time." But then she would never stand on her own two feet financially, or pay off her own nursing school loans, or buy a house just because she had the credit to do it. And she could not get him to understand why that was so important. The man who was beckoning to her was waving his arms, trying to get her to start moving again. If she ran now, she could save herself. Izzy felt Bex reach for her hand. She could imagine the effort and pain that cost the woman, and she gently laced her fingers with Bex's and squeezed. She leaned down. "You're going to be fine," she said. She drew a deep breath and took another long step forward. Once, when her brothers had been fighting over who got more spaghetti for dinner, her mother had said, "You don't look at another person's plate to see if they have more than you. You look to see if they have enough." Izzy thought of Dr. Ward bleeding on the floor, still inside. She let go of the handles of the wheelchair, turned, and ran back to the gaping mouth of the clinic door. Bex could tell the moment Hugh realized that she was the woman in the wheelchair. He took a step forward, and as if that had triggered it, Izzy turned and ran. Bex couldn't speak. Her eyes filled with tears as Hugh started to run toward her. But before he could reach her side, the paramedics were there, hoisting Bex out of the wheelchair and onto a gurney and loading her into an ambulance. She twisted, trying to see Hugh, trying to reach her hand toward him, but she was surrounded by people who were prodding and poking and shouting at each other. What if she got taken off to the hospital before she could talk to Hugh?
"What's your name, ma'am?"
an EMT asked.
"Bex."
"Bex, we're gonna take care of you."
She grabbed at his arm.
"Need to tell..."
"We'll contact your family as soon as we get you settled at the hospital."
Bex shook her head. The double doors started to close, and then suddenly she heard Hugh's voice.
"I have to speak to her," he said, "and I have to get her to an OR.
She, who knew his face better than perhaps anyone, saw the struggle etched in his features, the desire to connect with her warring with the determination to get her treated.
"You," she managed, "need..."
He turned, sending her a warning in his gaze.
"You need to tell me something, ma'am?"
Hugh glanced at the EMT.
"I'll need a moment of privacy," he said, dismissing the paramedic.
And then they were alone. She swallowed, emotion damning all the words she had thought she might never get a chance to say to Hugh.
"Bex,"
he moaned, leaning closer,
trying to figure out how to embrace her and settling for folding his hands around her own.
Are you all right?
Been better, she said.
Rin is in there, Hugh finished. I know. Is she
alive? Hiding.
A small sob escaped, and his head bent until his hair brushed her cheek. Bex looked at him and saw the shadow of Hugh as a boy, jackknifed with grief when his dog died, frustrated by a calculus problem set, furious when he didn't make the varsity football team. She wanted to reach out and pull him into her arms like she used to tell him that tomorrow would be easier. But she couldn't. This time, she was the cause of his pain.
Nobody knows, he said, his voice a whisper. Nobody can know. Do you understand that? If it gets out that my daughter is inside, I'm off the case. I have no control over the outcome here. Period.
He stared down at her, his eyes dark with pain.
Why, Bex? Why did you bring her here?
She thought of Rin, the way she smiled and raised her right eyebrow, like she had a secret. How she painted her nails in different colors because she could never pick just one. The time she reprogrammed all the Sirius XM radio channels in Bex's car after decreeing that her aunt needed to move past the 80s. She asked. Hugh's hands bit into her skin. She knew he was fighting to maintain control.
Rin needed... She had to have...
He couldn't force the words from his throat.
No, Bex said. Birth control. She didn't want you to know.
He closed his eyes. Were some betrayals kinder than others? Bex searched his face, waiting for a shimmer of forgiveness. Before she could find it, however, the EMT had reappeared.
Lieutenant, he said, are you finished?
Were they? Bex willed him to speak, to absolve her of blame. Instead, he let go of her hands, jumped out of the ambulance, and shut the doors. It felt like it took 100 years for Izzy to run the last 5 steps back to the clinic door. She forced herself to stare at the black seam that separated freedom from captivity, until a hand reached out and grabbed her by her braid, yanking her inside again. George let go of her long enough to close and lock the door, piled the furniture back against it.
Smart gal, George said. If you hadn't come back here, well, who knows how angry I might have got.
Izzy's head swam. She could still smell the pavement baking in the afternoon heat. She could see the necks of all the cameras trained on her as she walked away from the clinic door. She could hear Bex's shallow breathing as they went over each crack in the sidewalk. What kind of idiot tastes freedom and spits it out? She heard a groan behind her and turned to find Dr. Ward's wound trickling blood. Izzy met George's gaze. Can I? He nodded, and she got to her knees beside Dr. Ward, unwrapping the soaked tourniquet to replace it with a fresh one. As soon as the pressure was relaxed, blood poured from the wound. Izzy wondered how long she had before she needed to beg the shooter to let Dr. Ward get real medical attention. She had a feeling it was different from Bex, that George would see the doctor's death not as regrettable collateral damage, but as revenge. With quick efficiency, she began to tighten the makeshift bandage again by using the Sharpie as a winding key. She secured it into place with tape. Dr. Ward groaned when she moved his limb, and she tried to distract him with banter. You know, when I was a kid and my brother broke his arm, I just splinted it and told him to use the other one.
Where I grew up, we were so poor we didn't even have wood to make a splint,
Dr. Ward said.
Izzy smiled a little. Pretty sure I had the flu for a whole year because we couldn't afford a trip to the pediatrician.
We only went to the dentist if a cavity was so bad it made you throw up.
And braces, Izzy said, they might as well have been tooth jewelry. Dr. Ward offered a wobbly smile.
Girl, I know what you're doing, and you can't use my own medicine on me.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
You're trying to distract me from what's really happening down there with my leg.
You know what's happening down there, Izzy said.
Yeah.
He sighed.
If it's much longer, I could lose it.
Izzy tried not to think about that. More important, she had to make Dr. Ward not think about that. You talk like you're my only patient. She jerked her chin toward Janine, still unconscious from the blow George had given her with the butt of the gun. Any change?
No, Dr. Ward said, sobering. I've been watching.
Izzy made a small noise in the back of her throat. Well, she said,
I wouldn't mind if she stays unconscious.
Dr. Ward frowned.
Do you know I only once refused to perform an abortion?
Was it for a pro-life protester? Izzy asked. He hesitated, then shook his head.
It was a racist. A woman came in and saw me and said she preferred a white doctor. Problem was, I was the only person doing procedures that day, and she couldn't wait any longer to have it done.
Izzy sat back on her heels. What happened?
I have no idea. Even after she decided my skin color mattered less than her getting that abortion, I said no. I was self-aware enough to know that I had to treat myself like an impaired physician. I was intoxicated with anger, the same way I would have been if I had swigged a fifth of gin. I couldn't touch her any more than I would have touched a patient if I were drunk. What if she was uncomfortable during the procedure? She might think I was intentionally trying to cause her pain because of what she'd said. And what if there was a complication, and it reinforced her beliefs that I was less than qualified because of my skin color?
He shook his head.
Like Dr. King said, it may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important.
I would think that when it comes to abortion, race is the last thing on anyone's mind. Dr. Ward glanced up, surprised.
Why, Miss Izzy, when it comes to abortion, race is first and foremost in everyone's minds.
He nodded toward Janine.
She's the anomaly, you know. The average anti-choice protester is,
he lowered his voice,
a middle-aged Caucasian male.
Izzy looked at George Goddard. He was polishing the shaft of his gun with the hem of his shirt. They'd heard him talk about his daughter. They knew he had some personal connection to this clinic, but surely that wasn't true of every protester who fit that profile. Why?
Because they're trying to make America white again.
But more women of color have abortions than white women.
Doesn't matter. They don't care about the fertility of black women. They're using them the way black women have been used for centuries to further a white agenda. You've seen those black genocide billboards?
Izzy had. They sprouted on the highways in the deep south. They showed a picture of a beautiful little black baby and a slogan, "The most dangerous place for an African American is in the womb." A picture of President Obama and the words, "Every 21 minutes, our next potential leader is aborted."
White people are the ones who put those up. Race isn't exactly a walk in the park in this country,
Dr. Ward said.
If the antis frame their opposition to choice as anti-racism, it looks like they're trying to help black women. But a law that keeps black women from having abortions also keeps white women from having them. The only person who can give birth to a white baby is a white woman. Those same white women are working outside the home and bucking traditional family values. And by 2050, whites will be in the minority. When you look at it like that, it's a little clearer who those billboards are really benefiting.
He looked at Izzy's expression and smiled a little.
You think I've lost too much blood?
No, no. I just never thought of that before. Dr. Ward leaned back against the frame of the couch.
It's all I think about.
He glanced at her tourniquet.
You are one damn fine nurse.
Stop flirting now.
You're a little skinny and pale for my tastes,
he joked. Well, too bad. You're a unicorn, a smart guy who isn't threatened by women. I think you might be the biggest feminist I've ever met.
You bet I am. I love women. All women.
Izzy cut a glance toward Janine, still passed out on the floor.
All women? All women, Dr. Ward repeated. And you should too.
He turned to Izzy.
Like it or not, you're in this fight together.
Ren hadn't come here for an abortion. The numbing relief Hugh felt knowing that was eclipsed by the truth that she was still being held hostage because she wanted to get birth control. But she hadn't wanted him to know. Hugh would have taken her if she had just asked. Why hadn't she asked? Why had she gone to Bex? Why hadn't his sister confided in him? He knew Bex had been looking for mercy, for Hugh to say, "This wasn't your fault." But he hadn't been able to do it, because if it wasn't Bex's fault that Ren was in there, then Hugh had to admit that it might be his own. He wouldn't have flown off the handle if Ren had come to him. It wasn't in his DNA. In fact, he was so good at plastering his emotions with a thick layer of calm that it took someone who had known him all his life to know there were cracks beneath the surface. When Annabelle left Hugh, she had slapped him to see if she could get a rise out of him. Hugh had told Bex afterward.
She said no one could blame her for leaving me for someone with human emotions.
He had rested his elbows on his knees and buried the heels of his hands in his eyes.
The thing is, if you saw the stuff I do every day on the job, you'd do anything to not feel.
Bex.
How the hell could Bex have brought his daughter here?
He knew the answer to that. What his sister had envisioned was a free clinic, a half-hour appointment, and a prescription for the pill. The only person who would get hurt in this scenario was Hugh, for not being in the know. Bex hadn't thought about protesters or gunmen. She wouldn't have, swimming in the back of her consciousness, statistics of violence at other women's health clinics. Only someone who had been doing what Hugh had been doing for years would assume the worst could happen. The thing was, The worst hadn't happened yet. Bex was safe now, and Ren would be, no matter what it cost him. Beyond the command tent, the reporters had formed a line, each faced by a cameraman, like they were arranged for some courtly dance. Hugh heard the closest reporter spout absolute and total bullshit to fill up time on a live feed. "The question, of course," the reporter said, "is where did the gun come from? Who sold him the gun? It's worth remembering that a dishonorable discharge may be a military court ruling, but it's still a felony, and for Goddard to have a gun would be illegal." Hugh closed his eyes. He pushed away the voices of the reporters and thoughts of Bex and Ren hiding from a lunatic with a gun. "No distractions," he told himself. "No distractions." He dialed his phone, and George picked up on the third ring. "That was great," Hugh said. "You released someone who really needed help. I knew you and I could work together." Hugh wiped his forehead. It was hotter than hell. "I'm not working with you," George said. "You're a fucking cop." Hugh closed his eyes. It was going to be considerably worse when the SWAT team arrived, which could be any minute now, which meant he had limited time to woo his hostage taker. "I'm a negotiator," Hugh corrected. "You're the only reason I'm here." He forced himself to block out the people around him, emergency personnel and media. If he was going to do his job, he had to create a space that was just him, George, and no one else. It was a seduction, and Hugh would say anything he had to in order to reach the end game. "Look," Hugh said, "a lot of these guys out here, they make assumptions. Not me. I know you're smart. The fact that you let that woman get medical attention proves it." That woman. As if Bex hadn't basically raised him after his father died and his mother started drinking. He hesitated, waiting to see if George would take the bait. "Are there others inside who need help?" "I'm not letting anyone else go." "This could be a win-win, George. If there are more people in there with you who are hurt, and you send them outside, then you don't have to worry about them, and it makes you look compassionate to everyone out here." A young detective tapped Hugh on the shoulder. She held up a cell phone. "His pastor," the detective whispered. Hugh nodded and held up a finger for her to wait a moment. "George? Is anyone else in there hurt?" "Why should I tell you?" "Because you opened the door, and I kept my promise. I waited. I didn't rush the clinic and storm in. You can trust me." "To do what? Screw me over in the end?" The detective scribbled on a piece of paper and waved it beneath Hugh's nose. "Born again." "No, to do unto others as you would have them do unto you," Hugh said. "You a Christian?" "Yes," Hugh said, although he wasn't a religious man at all. "Are you?" He could hear George's breathing. "Not anymore." Hugh looked down at the piece of paper that the detective had handed him. "God will forgive you for what you've done, George."
"What makes you think I'll forgive him?"
George said, and the line went dead. Hugh grabbed the cell phone from the detective.
"Hugh McElroy," he said. "Who am I speaking to?"
"Pastor Mike Kearns," a man replied. "I lead the Eternal Life Church up in Denmark."
"Thanks for calling, Pastor. I understand you know George Goddard."
"George used to be our church handyman. Landscaping, carpentry, you name it. I don't think there's anything he can't fix."
"When did he stop working for you?"
6 months ago, give or take."
Shame crept into the pastor's voice.
We had some storm damage and the budget got tight. Now we have volunteers doing what George used to do.
Have you been watching the news today, Pastor?
No, I've been officiating at a funeral.
George Goddard shot up the center in Jackson, the abortion clinic, and is currently holding several hostages.
What? No. No, that isn't the man I know.
You didn't have time for this man's existential crisis. Did he exhibit any violent tendencies when you employed him?
George? Never.
Was he pro-life?
Well, the pastor said, our congregation believes in protecting the rights of the unborn.
Enough to kill people to get your message heard? The pastor drew in his breath.
I don't appreciate being tried for my faith, officer.
Lieutenant. Lieutenant McElroy. And I don't appreciate people who waltz into a clinic and start killing innocent bystanders.
Killing? My God. You can have him,
Hugh said under his breath. Listen, Pastor, I don't mean to attack you. But there are people in that clinic who might die. Anything you can tell me about George Goddard that could help me understand him and his motivations would be greatly appreciated.
I met him a little over 15 years ago,
Pastor Mike said.
He showed up one night in the church carrying his baby. She was sick, feverish. His wife was gone.
Dead?
No, she left him. But he never would say why.
Hugh's mind began to turn, mixing possibilities. Had she run because her husband was violent? Had he stolen the baby and left her? Was she still alive somewhere?
Do you know her name?
Hugh said, pulling the cap of a pen off with his teeth.
No, the pastor said. He wouldn't even speak of her. It was always just George and Lil.
Lil?
His daughter. Good girl. Used to sing in the church choir.
All Hugh had known about George's daughter was that she had come here for an abortion. But now he also knew her name. Hugh held his hand over the speaker of the phone.
Lil Goddard, he barked at the young detective. Find her.
Hugh knew all the ways to find someone who didn't want to be found. You looked at bank records and credit card receipts and phone records. You followed aliases and money trails. The primary advantage a detective had was that he was pursuing a truth, while the person hiding was living a lie. Truth tends to gleam, like the glint of a penny. Lies, on the other hand, are a series of loops. Eventually, they will trip you up. It had been the car radio that tipped him off. He had taken Annabelle's minivan to get the registration renewed, and on the way punched at the 5 pre-programmed radio buttons to find NPR. There was an oldie station, an acoustic station that always made him feel like he'd nod off at the wheel, a classical music channel, and one that played nonstop Disney tunes for Ren. The NPR station, however, had been reprogrammed to a country station. Hugh had punched through the buttons again. True, he was rarely in this car, but Annabelle hated country music. He could still remember her lying with her head in his lap when they were dating, telling him that what she hated most about the Deep South was the constant barrage of songs about men with trucks, men with cheating wives, men with cheating wives in trucks. Hugh had reset the radio channel to NPR, got his wife's car registration, had the oil changed, and even went through the car wash. He didn't think about it again for a week, until he came home early from work. He knew Ren would still be at school, and when he heard the shower running, he grinned and stripped off his clothes, planning to join Annabelle. It wasn't until he reached the bedroom that he heard her belting out, "Before he cheats."
He was still standing at the threshold of the bathroom when the water turned off and Annabelle opened the door, wearing a towel.
Hugh! She shrieked. You scared me to death. What are you doing here?
Playing hooky, he said.